Good evening. Good to see you all again. So the first two nights we talked about the first noble truth, and last night the second noble truth. I'm sure you can all guess what's coming next. And this third noble truth practice. And so really the way that I like to think of this third noble truth, this the Buddha saying that you can end suffering. Of course, we have to do a lot of work to get there. We've had to sit and acknowledge the dukkha and the difficulty and try to develop these qualities of kindness and friendliness and putting aside the mind, putting aside the craving and the clinging, and a lot of work. And so the way that we experience the third noble truth is by abandoning or letting go of or unhooking from that craving or that clinging in the mind, and that falls away and we experience release. And so the way that I think about this is I call this the heart's release. So I guess you could say that's the topic for this talk tonight, is really this: the release of the heart. Over the years in teaching meditation and the variety of contexts that I have, I'm always interested in paying attention and trying to notice, as I come into the room for the first time, what are some of the things that we bring into a meditation practice? What are some things that we bring into the practice before the bell even rings? What are some things we're bringing in with us that are already getting in the way of this heart's release, that are already getting in the way of our ability to be at ease? And I find the biggest one for most of us is what our attitude or what our view of what meditation is supposed to look like. The mind's supposed to be quiet. I'm supposed to feel at peace. I'm supposed to be calm. So before our butt hits the cushion and before the bell even rings, we're already coming into the meditation with a delusion or some confusion or some idea about what it's supposed to look like and how it's supposed to be. And so the way that we want to look at it is meditation, or really the practice of the Dharma, which we've been working with all week here, this Dharma, this truth of how things are, is really a process of subtraction, not addition. And we get so agitated and frustrated because we think, we strive and I'm going to do it. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to get it. Got to get the technique and get it right and do it and add it. And it's like, what is it? What's the thing about it? What's the bit? What's the thing to do that's going to get it going? Got to get the meditation going. So we try to add it in. Do I add the breath in? Or he said something about noticing my feet? Or is it this loving kindness? Or is it the sounds? He said something about the sounds. Well, what's the bit of it? What's the gist of it? We want to know what's the one thing. That I need to add to my already chaotic monkey mind. And we could say that the third noble truth or nirvana or nibbana or this release is actually the mind released from trying to find one thing. So we start to see, we start to come into our own direct experience, and we we start to see there's certain things that are happening, there's certain things that we're feeding, there's things that we're contributing to that we can say, oh, I don't need to do that. I don't need to make plans on this retreat. You can switch that off or notice, okay, that can go. The past and the resenting and the old blaming and the trying to figure out how I could have just made that relationship work if I just had been more like this or less like that. I would still be in that relationship and I wouldn't be so lonely sitting in this weird building in northern Thailand. Where did it all go wrong? Some point, it just, where did I go wrong? The past. You can switch that off too. Let that go. Subtract that out of the equation. Let's drop that for now. What else can we get rid of? The inner critic. The inner critic that says, yeah, I don't think you're doing this right, dude. I don't know what you're doing, but it's not good. And then what did he say? What was the instruction this morning? Gee, I wasn't even listening during the meditation instructions. I was making plans. Now I don't know the instructions for the day. The whole day is a wash. I might as well go to the store at the end of the street and get an ice cream and start over tomorrow. Even the idea that we're going to do this right is a delusion, is a view that, first of all, is definitely not going to help the meditation any. So maybe we can let that go. And so what have we learned so far? What have we seen from our own direct experience? You've probably seen all of these things. You've seen the reality of dissatisfaction. You've seen moments like this where you just totally feel unsatisfied. There's pain in the body. The mind is just thinking and thinking and thinking. My heart feels tired, burdened. So we're seeing this now. We're seeing this clearly in this practice. We're seeing this in mindfulness. We're seeing the First Noble Truth. We're understanding, oh, this is actually what it's like to be a human. You know, and then how do we switch that part off? Well, that's the part you don't switch off. That's the part we need to fully know. The application, the practice of the First Noble Truth is to fully know or to fully embrace. Now, how do you do that? What's the technique? There's a lot of them. We explore, we experiment, we investigate this present time reality of life and the conditions and all of these experiences coming and going, and we're, you know, to some extent sitting in the fire of our experience and just trying to see, feeling the overwhelm of it all. And we also come into a context like this, and we have the religion of Buddhism to blame for some extent, that we hear these words like enlightenment. And we hear words like fully liberated being, the fully liberated Buddha, totally enlightened. Sounds like Buddhist heaven, doesn't it? And we think, I want that. How do you switch that one on? Where's the switch? You know, like you know, we all come into this meditation, we come into this practice with this, mostly this idea that says, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to learn all the practices. I'm going to meditate. And at some point in time, ding, something's going to happen. Some event. Something in my life is going to happen. I'm going to understand things fully. I'm going to know the ultimate truth, or I'm going to... Something is going to happen, and on the other side of that event, life is going to be a walk in the park. It's going to be easy. No more problems, no more difficulties. Everything's going to go my way. When is it? So we strive, we look, we think, we cling. We want that experience. I want that. When am I going to have that? And the great humility of the Dharma, the great humility of the Buddhist teachings is the fact, and really I believe the reality, that awakening is the word I'll use. The word enlightenment came much later. The Buddha never speaks really of enlightenment in the early texts. He never speaks of things like light or illumination. This is a very Judeo-Christian idea. The Buddha just means awake. When people used to, there's stories where people would walk up to the Buddha and they would see him and he was radiating this presence. And people were like, what is up with you? What have you been smoking? And the Buddha would just say, I'm awake. I have woke up. I'm no longer asleep. And so when we think of this third noble truth, this experience that he had, this experience that we're looking for, waking up is very ordinary. You do it every morning. It's not a big, adventurous, romantic, understanding the true nature of the universe experience. It's a very ordinary, everyday experience. In like waking up, you notice when we wake up, it's a little bit uncomfortable. I don't know about you, but when I first wake up in the morning, I kind of get this, ugh, is it time to get up? It's painful, and the mind is a little confused and not really sure where we are, or what do I got to do today? What day is it? What country am I in? Am I on retreat? Am I teaching the retreat? You know, we get this, waking up is a little bit painful and a little bit confusing, and there's some grogginess to it. And then we start to see, oh, okay, it starts to make more sense. And the awakening process that the Buddha's talking about, I believe, is very much the same. We're waking up to something, and very much, as I said on the first night, we're waking up from something. And I would bet good money that everybody in this room at some point during this few days have had a moment, if not many moments, of actual awakening, where you just get that sense of, I'm here, it's okay, it's like this, don't need to do that, don't need to do that, it's pretty good. And then there's a sense of presence and confidence and a feeling of really refuge, a feeling of safety. A feeling of, oh, this is very ordinary. It's not necessarily profound experience. It's not this earth-shattering, heart-opening, aha moment. It's just a very simple, subtle way of noticing, what's it like if my mind has switched off all these things and my judgment's gone and my planning and my remembering and all of the turmoil, all of the mental proliferation and all of that has parted and there's some spaciousness in the mind and we notice, oh, this is what life is like. This is what it can be like to be in the mind. And sometimes even in that moment we don't really notice it. Because often it's fairly neutral. It's not overwhelmingly pleasant. It's just a kind of neutral contentment. And as I said on the first night, this sutta that comes from the Pali Canon, one of my favorite teachings of the Buddha called the Noble Quest. One of the few places where the Buddha actually describes and explains what this Dharma that he has reached is like. What is this Dharma I have reached, this experience that I have arrived into? And he says very clearly, this Dharma I have reached is subtle. It's very, very subtle. It's hard to see. It's difficult to awaken to. It's quiet, it's fine, it's excellent. It's sensed only by the wise. The word is it's rooted in the Vedana word, felt. It's an inner feeling. It's an inner knowing. It's a sensed by the wise. Very ordinary. It's very subtle. The Buddha's saying this experience we're looking for is it's right in front of you. It's just right here, but what's in the way? What's blocking it? And he says, people cannot see this Dharma that I have reached. They cannot see it because they delight and revel in their place. And what does he mean by that? He says that we cling and we grasp and we revel and we want to be in a place. This is that becoming I spoke of last night. We want to have some place in our role in society, in life, where we're this person who does this thing, and we're important, and we have money, and our life has meaning. We're preoccupied. And we become, and we not become. And we're so preoccupied, and we're so, to some extent, addicted to having a place. Happily ever after. The American dream as we have it. That we can't see the ground. You know, we miss the forest for the trees. And he says, people can't see this because they delight and they revel and they're preoccupied with trying to create this place. They do not see this ground. And you've been, whether you know it or not, you've been becoming familiar, you've been becoming intimately familiar with this ground. We could call it the groundless ground. Becoming intimately familiar with the fact that everything is changing and rising and falling. The ground is moving. The ground is unsatisfying because it's moving. Because you can't have anything. Even if you have the best meditation sit. Maybe yesterday morning you were in here for a half an hour thinking, yeah, got it. Where is it now? It's gone. Every pleasant meditative experience you've ever had in your life is completely gone now. Can't have it. And we don't see this impersonal nature. We're always trying to create a self, the right self that's going to be in the right place. That's going to make my life have meaning, and then I'll be happy. And we don't see this ground. The whole structure of mindfulness practice, the whole teachings of mindfulness practice are rooted in this word satipatthana. And when he says this ground, he uses the word tana. Tana means ground or foundation. And sati means to remember, to recognize. And the whole structure of mindfulness, the whole teachings of Satipatthana is to continue to see impermanence, unsatisfying, not me. We see it in the body. We see it in sensations. We see it in all the senses. We see it in feelings. But we don't see it because we're too busy trying to get it, to have it, or to get rid of it. We're negotiating with reality nonstop, and we're losing in every single moment. And he says they do not see this ground. And those who are dyed in desire, those who are dyed like a dye in a cloth, and clinging and grasping and hatred and getting rid of and having, do not see this ground. They do not see what goes against the stream. It's one of the places in the canon where the phrase against the stream shows up. So what we're trying to do, what we're attempting to do, is moving our perspective from place to ground, from place to ground. The place is permanent. We're trying to create a person to be, an experience to have, a retreat to remember. You know, how many times on retreat have you imagined what you're going to tell your friends or your loved ones or the people later about the retreat? Planning the conversation later about the experience you're having now. Being like, how much am I going to lie? I don't want to say it was all bad, but it mostly was all bad. You know, and then we're just gone. So we come into contact with this Dharma, this ground. And the sutta that I speak of, the Noble Quest, actually ends with the Buddha in one of the few places where he actually, there's the sense that he's having an inner conversation with himself. And he says, after realizing this Dharma that I've reached and realizing how difficult it is to see and how much work it has taken and how people are so preoccupied and so clinging to the world and to their place, he considered, he said, this Dharma I have reached is very difficult to work with. It's hard to see. He said his mind inclined towards not teaching the Dharma. He was like, if I was to teach this, it would be tiring and vexing for me. He's basically surveying the world and looking around and being like, man, this is not going to go down. People are not going to do this. They're not even going to want to try. They're going to think I'm crazy, probably. And so he said, out of compassion for the world, out of compassion for humans, and he said, he inclined his mind, and he said, you know, but some people will. Some people will get it. And he says, those with little dust in their eyes. I love this phrase. He said, those people who have a little bit of dust in their eyes, who don't have sandbags over their head, but those people who have a little bit of dust in their eyes, who are just a little bit asleep, they'll understand. And out of compassion for those people, he said, I will teach the Dharma. May it be so. And I don't know if you've ever had any dust in your eyes, but even just one little piece of dust hurts pretty bad, doesn't it? A little bit of dust in your eye, still pretty irritating. Because it's right in your eye. And so we see that this is part of his experience, is him knowing this isn't going to go down. And then so he is thinking about this, he's questioning it, and he's looking into his experience, and he's remembering, and he's asking himself, well, how did this happen? How did I achieve this awakening? What were the steps that I took? What were some of the things that I did? You know, so if I'm going to teach this, if I'm going to have to try to use the limitation of words, then I'm going to have to explain this to other people. And so this, oftentimes it's called these spiritual faculties, sometimes called indriya, support faculties. And one of the words that we hear not so much in Buddhism is this word that I want to speak about for a little while now, called faith. And so the Buddha, looking into his experience, how did I get here? He said, well, I had some faith, or I had some confidence that I actually could. He left his home at 28 years old. He went out and sought the spiritual traditions of his time, as I mentioned. He had some kind of sense. He had some inner confidence that there was something that he was going to be able to do somehow. He had the faith to go forth. He had the faith to reject and to denounce all of the traditions and all the spiritual teachings at his time and say, actually, none of what you're teaching me works. I'm on my own. And he had the faith to sit down underneath that tree and say, okay, like, what is it that's happening here? And so this word faith, we don't hear about it so much in Buddhism. And it's actually really quite important. And from a Buddhist perspective, faith does not mean what we're used to. I think most of us, when we think of the word faith or the way that we understand the word faith, would mean belief. So I have faith in my belief system. And this, from a Buddhist perspective, is very dangerous, actually. Oftentimes, religion is rooted in encouraging us to have blind faith. Say, just believe. You're like, but it doesn't make sense to me. Like, well, you just need to believe. And so the danger of this language, or the danger of this word, is that for many of us, faith meaning belief, it actually means that we're kind of clinging, or we're grasping, or we're holding to some kind of view. And so this is completely almost the opposite of the type of faith that we're looking for in this practice. So we might say, from a Buddhist perspective, we might say faith, we might say trust. We would say refuge, taking refuge, looking for safety, trusting into something that's worthwhile, that's possible. The word that makes most sense to me, or the idea of this that makes most sense to me, is just this experience of confidence. And we all know confidence. We all know what it is. But it's, you know, it's not a thing. It's not a technique. It's not like I can sit down and say, okay, well, I'm going to teach you some practices so you can learn confidence. So I use the word spiritual. It's a spiritual faculty. It's just an inner wisdom. It's just sort of a knowing that, oh, there's a sense of I can do this. And so it's not so important to know what confidence or what faith is, but it's very important to know when it's present. It's very important to know through mindfulness when you feel it, when you feel it, when you're coming into contact with it. And I would imagine and hope that many of you have felt this throughout the retreat. There's been times where you've been sitting or you've been doing some heart practices and you've had this sense of, oh, I can do this. Maybe this is working. And the Buddha says these five factors, they merge in the deathless. They don't die. They just keep going. They carry us through. They help us all the way down the line, all the way down the path. And when it comes to this confidence or this faith, this trust, whatever word you want to ascribe to it, one thing that the Buddha said too that's also very inspiring is he said, the Dharma is good in the beginning, in the middle, in the end. And so it doesn't matter for us where we are on the path. It doesn't matter where we are in the practice. It's that we found something that we can verify for ourselves that works, even if we've just seen glimpses of it. And it's good in the beginning. And this is helpful because oftentimes people come into the practice at points in their life and a lot of people I know, it starts to work, the Dharma starts to work, and they start to become excited and inspired, and they want to sit retreats, and they want to do more meditation, and they want to learn more about the teachings, and they sometimes have a feeling of, oh, I wish I started this many years ago. I wish I was introduced to this earlier on. And so, you know, that's not a helpful perspective at all, is it? So we just notice it's good in the beginning because in the beginning what we learn, hopefully, what we start to see is this importance of these ethics that I keep speaking about. You don't have to be an advanced meditator. You don't have to sit a million retreats. You don't have to be the Zen master at the mountaintop to learn kindness. A 3-year-old child can learn kindness. So we start to see that we have access to, or we have these innate qualities of the heart. We can be kind to ourselves. Maybe we didn't know that. But we see in meditation, we see moments, we see in the meditation practice and the metta practices, I care about myself. I want to be kind to myself. I want to be kind to my mind. So it's good in the beginning because we can taste this fruit of liberation. We see it's right here for us. It's just been right here the whole time. We didn't have to meditate for a million hours to get it. We just had to look and see and turn towards and try to pull it out and see that it was there. And so we can find confidence in that. We can trust that. We can see for ourselves that this quality, this is a reliable thing. This is something that I can do. And so this faith, this factor of faith, whatever word you want to ascribe to it, we start to see that we'll find moments when it's there. And the opposite of faith for many of us, and the opposite of faith from this Buddhist perspective would be what's called the hindrance of doubt, which the Buddha said is the most dangerous hindrance of the mind, is this doubt, self-doubt. I can't do it. It doesn't work. I'm no good. Can't do it. Not good at anything. Not good at this. This sense of doubting ourselves. This factor of faith, or sometimes it's called sadha, destroys that. You can't feel confident and full of doubt at the same time. Those cannot coexist simultaneously. And so we overcome this hindrance of doubt and we keep going. We stay with it. So important. So not talked about enough. And so it's a spiritual faculty. It's a support faculty. It's an indriya. What is it, right? Again, it's there or it's not. So we want to, with mindfulness, we want to notice. We want to encourage that. We want to learn how to encourage that. So we have this faith factor, so important. The next one the Buddha realized was I had faith and I had confidence. I had some sense that I could do it. And then I put effort in, which is also the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. But he saw, I tried, I was diligent, I sat, I looked, and I looked, and I looked. And so we see the effort, the willingness to keep going even when it gets hard. The willingness to sit for the 7 more minutes of the sit, even though you want to walk out that door so bad. I want out of here. Praying the dude rings the bell. Please ring that bell. And with the effort, we keep going. And I could talk about right effort all evening because it's something the Buddha spoke about often. And this effort is something that we need to know for ourselves what the right amount of effort for you is, because we're all different. And so we don't want to be too tight, but we don't want to be too loose. We want to find a balanced effort so that way we don't burn ourselves out or that we don't become too slack. We keep striving on. We keep going on with something once we verified and we have confidence. We say, I know this works. I've seen it. I've sat with it. I've seen love and kindness in my heart. I've seen compassion in my heart. I know it's there. And when we don't feel it at times, we go for it anyway. We meditate anyway. So important. The third factor, the third spiritual factor, is once he saw he had faith and he had effort, he said, mindfulness. I was mindful. I was aware. I was noticing what was happening. I could see my direct experience. And to some extent, all of the roads lead back to mindfulness. You can never have too much mindfulness. So this is why we practice, so important to practice, is because we cultivate awareness and we cultivate awareness and we cultivate this awareness so that we can continue to see things more clearly. So he had faith, he had effort, he had mindfulness, which merged in concentration or collectedness. Is now that he had mindfulness, he was able to notice what things needed what. What was it that was arising? Oh, this craving, this clinging is arising. Well, I can let that go. Compassion is arising. Oh, feed that. This is good. Stay with that. To some extent, mindfulness is about cultivating the wholesome and abandoning the unwholesome. And we need mindfulness to do that. We need to see what's arising to do that. We also need to be able to concentrate and notice, again, what can we turn off? What can we let go of? We don't need to do that. Let that one go. Let that one go. Here's some effort. Here's some faith or confidence. Okay, be with that. Let's be with this one. This is the good. This is the better than. And all of these faculties merge in what's called wisdom and understanding and just knowing now, okay, I'm going in the right direction. And so these faculties, these experiences, these the ways in which the Buddha came to understand or came to realize this third noble truth support us on our path. And mindfulness, again, so important because what it does is it balances the other factors. Sometimes we can have too much faith, too much confidence, and maybe we become arrogant or we think we know everything and we're out of balance with wisdom. Or we can have too much wisdom and, you know, read all the text and start to understand Buddhism psychologically and we have too much wisdom out of balance with actual faith. Mindfulness is sometimes likened to the fulcrum that kind of holds everything together. So he kept looking in and saying, okay, these are here for us. We don't, and they're not really things, they're not techniques, are they? So I'm like, well, how do you do effort? How do you do mindfulness? How do you do these things? It's just important to know when they're present. And to know that they're there, to know when they're there, when we can draw them out. And they grow, they change. I mean, for me, and many years ago, you know, I've had an ongoing kind of doing the Dharma and falling off, and doing the Dharma and falling off. I've never, much disappointment often for me is I wish that I could say that I was turned on to the Dharma practice and I was introduced to the Dharma when I was 19 and I've been practicing ever since. And that just hasn't been the case. You know, because the faith or the confidence I became delusional again. I would wake up and I would fall back asleep and sometimes I would fall back asleep for many years. And ironically, the paradox of it all is everything, every time I would wake back up, it was always because of suffering. And my back would get to the wall or I would get back into some experience in my life where there was some more loss or there was all that addiction. And I would be suffering so bad. I would be suffering so bad and I would wake up and go, oh yeah, what was that Dharma practice I used to do? I used to do something with this. I used to have something to rely on. And then I would wake back up. And so again, it's good in the beginning, in the middle, and the end, because we can start over anytime. We can start over in every moment. And again, this idea that we're just going to have this event where we just wake up and we're just going to stay awake and just got it done. Whew, I'm a Buddhist now. I don't suffer anymore. You know, this type of labels that we wear. We see this a lot, and I see this a lot back home in the States of people who become identified as Buddhists, and now they kind of start acting weird. I'm like, I know you still suffer. Stop acting weird. They start wearing the Tibetan clothes, or they start talking quietly, or they start being harsh on me because I swear too much. They say, "Oh, you shouldn't swear." I'm like, "You used to swear all the time." And so we want to be careful we don't become too identified with some of this stuff. You know, and for me over the years is this practice of the third noble truth is the more that I see it and the more that I experience it and the more that I sort of live from this place, the more I see how ordinary it is. It's not really such a big thing. And so the wisdom again is like everything kind of just keeps turning itself over. And part of mindfulness, sati, means to remember. And we need to remember that which we forget. And we forget a lot. How many times are you down here sitting in the hall meditating and you forgot that you were meditating? And you're like, snap out of it. You're like, oh yeah, right, I'm supposed to be doing something. Or you forget that you're on retreat. Oh yeah, I'm on a retreat. And then so we remember. And so we come into contact with all of these different possibilities and we start to see that there's lots of factors and there's lots of different possibilities that we can engage in at any time, and we don't become too belief-oriented around our technique, or we don't become too belief-oriented around our being identified as a Buddhist or not a Buddhist or whatever we ascribe to the practice that we're doing now. It's better to be a Buddha than to be a Buddhist. Just be, if you want to be a Buddhist, if you want to really embrace these practices, be kind. Don't talk about how kindness is important. Be kind. Don't talk about how important it is to have compassion. Just be compassionate. Because when we place these types of practices on some sort of intellectual pedestal, it just becomes another view or another thing that we cling to, that we believe in, and doesn't really have a practical or a pragmatic effect on how we live our lives. It's just now we just believe this. And I oftentimes find myself guilty of this as I've studied and become more, as I move through this kind of teacher role and going from teaching weekly classes to teaching in different places and then being invited to places like this. And, you know, I have to watch out for that. Of like, oh, I'm getting preoccupied with my place. This, I'll be happy when I am a successful Dharma teacher who gets to travel around and teach retreats. You know, and what happens is I become preoccupied with that notion of becoming that person and living in that place that I forget the whole reason I'm doing that was to let all that go. And so when we look at these Four Noble Truths, when we see them as a practice, when we bring mindfulness to these ideas and these sometimes teachings or the Buddha's packaging everything in these nice little lists for us so we can remember them, is that this first noble truth, this truth of dukkha, he's saying we have got to continue and we have got to maintain some honesty about the difficulties in our life. And you're always going to have difficulties in your life. If you stop having difficulties in your life, please give me a call and let me know how you got there. Because I'll switch teams in a second. Come do what you're doing. And this is ongoing. This is how it is. We break down this term that they use in Buddhism called ignorance or avijja, which I just experience as denial. We understand that the denial is what causes us suffering so much of the time. And we become willing to turn towards that which is painful. And we see, as we did this afternoon, that there's compassion. Maybe there's only a little bit, but you see that it's there. Or you see that there's a hunger there for that. And we start to develop compassion. We start to develop kindness for the difficulties in our lives. And we turn towards that. We stop running from that which we know hurts. So we keep doing this. We keep doing this. We take this on. We say, okay, I'm no longer willing to live in denial. I'm no longer willing to cause suffering for myself because I don't want to see the truth about the way my life is. I don't want to see the truth. I don't want to face the reality of how hard it's been for me. And as we become able to do this, this first task, a teacher, Stephen Batzer, who I really, really like a lot, talks about the Four Noble Truths as the Four Noble Tasks. The Buddha is not saying, believe this. He's saying, do this. Here's the doing. And as we're able to do that, we're starting to bring awareness and we're starting to understand the second noble truth about the reactivity and the craving and the clinging. And we're starting to see, we're starting to become aware of the causes. We're starting to become aware of the ways in which we cause unnecessary suffering for ourselves by clinging to place, by wanting to become something other than we are, by wanting our past to be different, by wanting our future to be completely painless and free of drama and chaos. And we see this becoming I spoke of last night. We see this ongoing desire to be in a different moment, to be in a different body, to be a different person, to be a different place, a different thing. We see the suffering of wanting other. And we start to switch that off. We start to say, we abandon that. I like this word, abandon. I feel like it's like I'm dropping it off at the side of the road and keep driving. Like, get out of here. You're gone. It's like this abandon. It almost has a fierce, courageous aspect to it. We abandon it. We abandon it. We abandon it. And so we become more and more aware of the ways we cause ourselves suffering, and we become able to unhook. We become able to let go. And when we're able to do these first two things, we start to live, and we start to experience, and we start to feel confident, and we start to really become optimistic. And we start to become inspired by living in this experience of the Third Noble Truth. That we can release ourselves from the unnecessary suffering. At the same time, acknowledging that we've had to do quite a bit of work to get that. And we start to see that this is what we really have been looking for the whole time. It's the humility, it's humble, it's ordinary, it's a contentedness, it's probably neutral, it's a sense of it's okay. Like I said at the beginning of the first night or the end of the first night, that the more I do this and the more I do these practices and the more I go up against all of the stuff I want to run from, I just get this ongoing sense that mostly life, it's okay. It's going to be hard at times. It's going to be like this. It's, you know, I feel like I've seen every emotion in my mind. All of the inner violence and the grief, pain. It's like I don't see anything new anymore. It's not like I don't get that much. It's more of, oh, that again. Well, here's that again. Here's loneliness one more time. Big surprise. And so what happens is my relationship to loneliness changes. And I can be lonely and I can feel lonely, and I actually, to be honest with you, for the most part, am lonely. And it's okay. Because I know that I'm not alone, and I know that this is how it is, and I know that this is probably temporary. I don't hate it. And for me to sit here and say I don't hate loneliness and actually not be lying to you is an amazing accomplishment. And so we start to become optimistic about the alleviation. We start to get this indriya, this factor of confidence and faith. It starts to happen more often than it used to. It starts to be something that we see, we notice. We start to notice what are the conditions for that to arise. As we abandon the difficult, the unwholesome qualities, what we're doing is we're making space for this other room. There's only so much room. And so we subtract, we let go of this clinging and craving and becoming, and I'm going to be happy when, and it's going to be all good when, and I wish it wasn't like this, and I wish it wasn't like that, and how come this didn't happen, and how come that didn't happen, and when did it all go wrong anyway? I was so happy in the mid-90s. How can I get back there? You know, what it does is we let that go. We create space for this whole new other experience to come in. And once we start to taste that, or we start to get a sense, and again, it's not a kind of intellectual knowing. It's not a information type of knowing that we're so used to. It's a much more deeper spiritual embodied sense than that. It's a sense that something's here. There's something here. I'm not sure what it is. It feels pretty good. It seems reliable. I'm okay. I feel confident. I care about myself. My mind still does things I don't want it to, but that's okay. We start to have this kind of humility for our humanity, and we start to see that this practice, what we're looking for is, again, like the Buddha said, it's subtle. It's kind of no big deal. It's not a big, epic, radical shift. It's a slow grind. And again, to use the cultivation metaphor, it's like, you know, you could take the best genetically grown seed in the world, and you could place it in the deepest, dark, richest, most fertile soil, and you could put that seed in that dirt and sit back and go, all right, come on, apple tree, I'm watching. Right? And you could watch, and you could watch, and you could watch, and because it happens so slowly, you don't actually get to see it sprout, grow roots, and come through the ground. But you come back in a year or two, and it's a little tree. Come back 5 years later, it's a bigger tree. Come back 10 years later, and there's these delicious apples, or however long it takes. And so when we start to look at meditation as a practice of subtraction, not addition, we also want to understand that it's a practice of cultivation, not assessment. And this is where the role of faith in these spiritual faculties really support us. Because when we meditate, right, we're trying to cultivate loving kindness, we're trying to cultivate compassion and mindfulness. And instead of just trusting in that and sitting in here and going, okay, like, this is what I'm going to do, the mind wants to assess, it wants to evaluate. So we get stuck in this kind of cultivation versus evaluation. And we're sitting and we're meditating and the mind comes in and goes, making any progress down there? I mean, dude, you've been doing this for 3 days now. I don't know, it's not looking good. You still hate the pain. You don't have any compassion for your suffering. In fact, you're suffering more now. And so this evaluation, it's like always wants to check in and see how the progress is going. And that just, again, that doesn't help. And we're so, living in the modern world, we're so goal evaluation, value oriented, that to try to find faith and confidence in something that happens as slow as this is a challenge for many of us. We don't have the patience. We go for the quick fix again, like I talked about last night. We go for that which will feel better now. And it puts us in a unique position. But the thing we have to understand is that, of course, now we're in this conversation of the third noble truth. And what comes next where the practice heads is it heads into the Eightfold Path, which is how we continue to strive and we continue to work on this practice. And the Eightfold Path is headed by right view. So we have to cultivate this stuff, and we have to remember that we need to have this, you know, not belief, but this view, this understanding of how it is. We have to continue to acknowledge the reality of the Four Noble Truths. And we start to have this, our perception about life and what it means to be alive. Like I said on the first night, what is this life for? Our perception about that changes. And so we enter into this appropriate view or this right seeing, or we understand how things really are. And then we keep going with that. We keep going with that as best we can. And the reason why we have to be very careful about the evaluation strategy is because, and I see this in myself so much, is that because the view and the perception changes over time, and we're always looking through a lens that's a little bit delusional, is that I can't assess my progress with the mind itself. Because I can't see how much better I'm doing, because I can't actually go back in my mind and go, what was it really like over here? Because I don't know, I'm not there anymore, I don't have that. So whatever the current doubts and whatever the current delusions and the current fears are, I'm tracking my progress through that lens as well. This is why community and Sangha is so important, because a lot of times other people can see the progress in us much clearer than we can. And so much throughout the teachings, the Buddha makes a very important emphasis on sometimes called right association and being very careful and very, very wise about the people that we spend our time with, who we talk to, who we hang out with, who we share the intimate details of our suffering with. And so as we, and I'll speak more about this in days to come, as we move out of the retreat experience, as we go out into the world, we want to be very discerning and we want to be very careful about who we talk to, who we spend our time with, who we trust. Because if we're the people with little dust in our eyes, that means most of the world has got sandbags over their head. And other people in the world will talk you out of the practice way faster than you'll talk them into it. And as you all know, I'm sure, the world out there is a jungle. There's so much suffering and confusion and greed and hatred. And so we want to protect it. At some point, we have to be very careful. We have to protect our hearts and we have to protect our practice. We have to be clear. We have to be careful about who we hang out with, who we spend our time with, who we let into our weird little worlds. And you're so lucky, you're all so lucky to be in such a fortunate environment like they've created here. This is such a healing. I've just been very inspired and encouraged spending some days here and just seeing all of the hard work that people are doing here and all of the care that the staff and all of the intention that has gone into creating a place where people can come and learn about the Dharma and learn about mindfulness and learn about trauma and learn about suffering and finding solutions that are actually, finding solutions that actually work and make a difference in the quality of the lives that we have. And so we're learning to train the mind. The mind is to be trained. The attention is to be trained. And so we do this hard work on the cushion every day. We come back, we come back, we come back. We train the mind so that the mind becomes more clear and more steady and more focused. And as we train the mind, the heart naturally becomes liberated. As we train the mind and go down into it, we see that the heart has these qualities. We see kindness, we see forgiveness, we see compassion. We see we have it. However large, however small the amount, we see that it's there. And also as we liberate the heart, we're also training the mind. So as we train the mind, we liberate the heart starts to look out for the mind. It says, no. Get away from there. We don't do that anymore. We don't let that go. You don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to have that view about yourself anymore. You don't need to feed that anger and shame and confusion anymore. That's harmful. We don't do that anymore, and we get the mind out of there. And we start to become more integrated in our system. And again, all of these factors, the faith will come, the effort will come. If the faith is there, the effort comes. Have you noticed if you have confidence how easy it is to do something? If the faith is there, the effort will come. When the effort's there, the mindfulness will come. When the mindfulness is there, the concentration, the focus will come. And all of these factors merge in wisdom and understanding what needs to be done. So I offer this for your reflection. These are some of my ideas and experiences, and I encourage you to investigate them for yourselves and see what's true for you. So let's just sit quietly for a minute or two.